What's up, guys? It's Kid Carson.
This is Alexandra Kitty.
This is Danielle Smith.
Hey, everybody. This is Paul Brandt.
Jeremy McKenzie, RagingDissident.com. Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Wednesday. Hope everybody's week is cruising along. We got some good one. Well, I got another good one on tap for you today. But the week is flying by. Let's get to today's episode sponsors, Blaine and Joy Steffen, Guardian Plumbing and Heating, and the 2021 Lloydminster Chamber of Commerce Business of the Year, with a team of over 30 who thrive on solving your problems and offering the best possible solutions. They got 24-hour emergency service available, as we know, in the wee hours of the night. You're not waiting to get things back online or back going. You need help immediately, and they certainly do that with 24-hour emergency service. Also, for all the farmers in the area, they have developed and manufactured the world's most efficient grain dryer right here in Lloydminster. You can find out more at guardianplumbing.ca, where you can also schedule your next appointment at any time. The Deer and Steer Butchery out on Range Road 25 on Highway 16 and Range Road 25. They're looking, any of the hunters looking to get your animal in, they're open for business. Of course, cattle and everything else, all your beef needs. They've opened their spot up to some different, facts about animal meat as hopefully here shortly. I got a couple different guests coming on to talk about it, but animal products like meat are the only natural source of vitamin B12, which promotes brain development in children and helps your nervous system function properly. And they just want to promote some of the benefits of meat, as you know, in society we move closer and closer to crickets and everything else. Give them a call today, 780-870-8700. Gartner Management, Lloydminster-based company, specialize in all types of rental properties to help meet your needs. Whether you're looking for a small office or a 6,000 square foot space, give Wade Gartner a call, 780-808-5025. Now let's get on that tail of the tape, brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals, delivering to your farm, commercial, or oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. He's a former research chemist, amateur dairy goat farmer, a libertarian, and economist whose work can be found on sites like Zero Hedge, LouRockwell.com, Bitcoin Magazine, and Newsmax Media. I'm talking about Tom Luongo. So buckle up. Here we go.
This is Tom Luongo, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. This morning, I'm joined by Tom Luongo. So first off, sir, thanks for hopping on.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, Sean. Thank you for the invite.
Now, there's going to be a ton of people who've never heard Tom before. So how about we start with, who is Tom? Tom, who are you?
Well, I am a guy that, like many of you out there, was just as confused about the world 20 years ago and just as angry at the world 20 years ago as y'all are today. Like, seriously, this is not my first love. Politics, geopolitics, finance, markets, all that stuff. I'm a chemist by trade, actually, that just, once my career dried up, I turned my hobby, which had become politics and economics and all of this stuff, into, well, hey, let's do what I've been advising people to do for years, which is to monetize your hobby. And now it's just kind of turned into the thing that it is today. And then, of course, being me, and if you've ever seen me before, you'll know that I'm pretty much not fit for human consumption on a regular basis. And in a world of dominated by HR departments and, with a social media profile that I have, and that's not hard to figure out, there was no way I was ever going to get hired by corporate America ever again anyway.
Why is that?
Simply because I am as contrary and as un-PC as one could possibly ask for. And in this environment, the purpose of HR departments is to make sure that people like me don't have jobs. So I know a lot of people are going through this and they're going, but I'm good at what I do, or I have to keep my mouth shut because I'm not allowed to explain that I'm a libertarian or I'm conservative, or I'm not allowed to do this. We live in an age where you're being silenced for you're being silenced simply because of who you are. And not what you do. And now in a highly politicized world, and I'm a hardcore libertarian, and by extension, my economic analysis is highly Austrian, which makes me a hard money kind of guy. I write a blog called Gold, Goats, and Guns, for Christ's sake. You know, do the math, right? So that's it. That's who I am. And then all this is done is that once I got hired by Newsmax to write a newsletter for them back in 2013 and was relatively successful at this and had just built a very loyal, I knew over the course of the 4 years that I worked for them that my retention rate was incredibly high within the industry. And then I was, you know, that whatever I was doing was resonating with the small cadre of people that I had, you know, we were able to hold on to in that space. And, you know, since then, you know, marketing what I do is very, very difficult because it's kind of rarefied and really kind of orthogonal to, you know, any kind of mainstream or even mainstream alternative takes on politics and markets. Like even the Zero Hedge crowd has problems with what I do. And Zero Hedge is like the king of alternative finance and alternative politics. And even then I'm one step farther along that path than they are. And because of that, it just means that there's a kind of a small group of that. But once, you know, but my original relationship with Newsmax ended in 2017. And, you know, I thanked them for the opportunity and I learned a lot. And I realized that, look, there's a market out here for this stuff. I just need to figure out, I just need to find these people. And it took me a while, but now we're here. And then interestingly enough, 2.5 years into that project, Newsmax hired me back to edit a different newsletter. And now I do both of those gigs at the same time. So I have my independent newsletter, Gold, Goats, and Guns, the Patreon, all of that. And then and then I also write for Newsmax. And I write Ultimate Wealth Report for them. So,
well, and we'll make sure to post a couple links in the show notes. That way, if people want to find you, Tom, they can. You mentioned you were at 20 years ago. You're at where a lot of people are right now. What was it 20 years ago that you set you off on this course, or have you always been on this course and it just kind of, you know, culminated 20 years ago?
Well, what happened with me was that I was always angry and hated politics. I was completely apolitical for years up until I was on practically 32 years old when I, you know, during Y2K. I think it was losing all my money in the NASDAQ crash of the Y2K crash. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was a lot of money to me. But it just set me on that path of what happened here. I don't understand what happened. And I thought I understood what was going on. And my arrogance, you know, was, you know, just like everybody else, I got killed because I didn't know what I was doing. And I don't like not knowing what I'm doing. I'm a root cause analysis kind of guy. That's what I did when I was a chemist. It's what I did. It's what I've done everywhere I've ever gone, which is to see problems and then fix them. And I was, you know, in all the places that I ever worked at as a chemist, I was always brought in to fix a problem. If it be just, you know, process flow or whatever it happens to be. My last job was in the metal coatings industry where I fixed, with no background in electrochemistry and metallurgy, I fixed a 55-year-old problem of a particular style of electroless nickel boron, not knowing anything really beyond what I was taught in general chemistry about electrochemistry. So, okay, it's time to get a PhD in electrochemistry and metallurgy and then unofficially, and then turn around and fix this problem. And it took me 5 years, but, you know, I solved it. And now it's out there in the world and doing its thing. Too bad the coating that I perfected wasn't, you know, a better product, wasn't anything more. If it was more than a niche product, we wouldn't be talking right now because I'd be sitting on my own private island with, you know, billions of dollars in my pocket. But
you're not on a private island right now?
What's that?
You're not on a private island right now?
Well, no, unless you consider my 13-acre farm up here in North Florida, which we lovingly call Outer Luongolia, you know, my own private island. So, you figure it out.
You know, you mentioned you're a guy who sees problems and wants to fix them. Right now, I think we could both agree there seems to be problems absolutely everywhere. That might be putting it lightly. What are some of the problems you see, and for yourself or your followers, your listeners, your kind of group, how are you trying to, I don't know, fix them is the right word, but maybe try and adjust for what's going on? Because there's a lot happening right now.
The problem isn't, we can't fix any of this. I think I was on the first time I try to explain where my head is in looking at capital markets and looking at the geopolitical structure of the world. And for those of you who don't know, I firmly believe at this point that the Federal Reserve is acting on the basis of American sovereignists to take the American government and the American system back from European globalists centered around Davos and the World Economic Forum. And I, and there's some people actually think that that's a naive take on this thing. And I'm like, well, okay, then you're like, do you believe in flat earth too? Oh, okay, great. So, but that is where we are in this fight. And then this fight doesn't make any sense because what we're seeing is as the system breaks down, as the financial system breaks down, which everybody can see, and the political system's breaking down. And this is all just an aftershock of 2008, which is also an aftershock of Y2K and 9/11. These are all just points on a timeline leading to what is effectively a crescendo of this current geopolitical and economic system that supports it. And that was always going to fail. Any Austrian, going back to the Austrian economists or Austrian style economists, going back to the 1940s, could tell you where we were going to wind up, which is where we are today. Now, when we were going to get there was not part of the analysis. This is a qualitative analysis and a quantitative analysis, right? And so when you make qualitative arguments, you can persuade people with the rightness of your logic and your analysis and everything else, but you cannot say anything about time because timing is a thing to the gods. It's the systems are too complex for anybody to perceive when the timeline is going to, when events are going to catch up with themselves. And therefore, so you just have to like make yourself prepared emotionally and intellectually for what's on the horizon. But at the same time, when you kind of you can consider that kind of strategic thinking, but at the same time, you tactically have to go through on a day-to-day basis or a month-to-month basis, what are you going to do with your money in the interim while you're waiting for what the sword of Damocles is hanging over your head? What do you do? I mean, it could hang over your head your entire life. You know, this thing might not collapse until your grandchildren are entering their 20s or their 30s. You don't know when the timing is, so you have to assess where things are today. And then project them out in a reasonable time, reasonable timeline. But you have to start with good first principles. We live in a world where we have been told that our first principles of economic and political life are correct when they're fundamentally wrong. Okay, we have Marxist politics and Keynesian economics, and those two things together have got us where we are today. And It's pathetic, frankly, that we have to spend so much time just even having that discussion that those two things are dumb. When Keynesianism was debunked in the 1970s with the stagflation then, because they said they could never have an inflationary depression under Keynesian economic model, only a deflationary depression. And we had an inflationary depression then. And then Marxism was debunked by the history of the 20th century.
You gotta, I'm going to slow you down because sure. I want to, certainly a student of history, Marxism, I hear it and I go, I think for most of the audience, they probably understand, but Keynesian economics, I'm not a student of economics, I guess. And so sure. If you wouldn't mind just breaking it down for me, Tom, and the listener.
It's a very simple thing. The Keynes and Hayek were Friedrich Hayek, and Friedrich Hayek is a lesser light within Austrian circles, as far as I'm concerned, because his political theories were horrific. But in the 1930s, while we were going through the last great sovereign debt crisis and the last great depression, Keynes and Hayek were celebrities arguing on the pages of the New York Times whether we should have no government intervention into the situation or maximal government intervention into the system. Keynes, of course, Keynes's general theory, published in 1936, made the argument, and I use that term loosely because the logic involved in this argument is torturous, if not, and convoluted at best, and that's being kind, it's intellectual gobbledygook, made the argument that in order to mitigate the effects of the natural business cycle, the boom and the bust that comes with the natural emotional ebb and flow of the economy as expressed by human behavior and human decisions. We make good decisions and bad decisions. in the aggregate, the business cycle is run comes from a concentration of one versus the other. And the boom is the thing that has to be, there's always going to be malinvestment during a boom time. And that malinvestment will eventually overwhelm the boom and that'll have to be liquidated. Then we have a bust and then we, and then the bust is over and then that capital is moved around and we get another, and we get another boom cycle started. And this is a natural thing. And we're, it's actually an upwardly sloping line of human value creation, but we don't do it in a straight line. We do it in an upward sloping sine wave. Okay. Well, Keynes's argument is that we can have governments come in and countercyclically spend money that they don't have through deficit spending to mitigate the amplitude of that sine wave and try and crush it down to a line. Okay? That's the argument. It's a terrible argument because the Austrians have quite convincingly, and you can even argue the Aristotelians and, you know, from a Greek philosophy perspective, have also made this argument quite convincingly that when you do that, all you're doing is by distorting the natural market all from away from where people want to put their money, you then are introducing loss due to friction, loss due to the enforcement of these rules, which will never be overcome by the stimulus you get from doing the thing you said you wanted to do through deficit spending. And so every government intervention begets a greater government intervention, and eventually the whole thing, eventually the interventions, which are fueled by debt, means that you eventually wind up with more debt than you can service, and all economic growth has to stop until we have either we write down the debt and bring all the assets down in value, because all everybody's asset valuations are based on faulty valuations based on the continued issuance of new debt on top of old debt, keeping asset prices higher, and that we either write all those down and bring the price general price level down by 90%, or we inflate the debt away and hyperinflate the economy. This is why Ron Paul has very famously said hyperinflation and hyperdeflation are two sides of the same coin. It doesn't matter. They're both the same thing. One is prices and the other one, they wind up being the same thing. Your purchasing power is destroyed in the process, okay? The purchasing power of your savings is destroyed in the process because your savings is what your investments are, right? Or at least you think they are. And that's the other thing we've done is to tell people don't save, invest. And Keynes made this argument as well, saying if people save too much, the paradox of thrift, that's actually a drag on the economy and you should be good consumers and you should go out and you should spend and let the government worry about the value of your savings, which is complete nonsense. Now politicians love this stuff.
And why? Why do politicians?
Because it gives them power. It gives them a point in the marketplace. It gives them a justification to go in and intervene in the markets and pick winners and losers and arrogate power to themselves and expand government regulations and allow corruption to enter the system, because now there's a point of corruption where politicians can get paid off by a corporation to get a bill passed through Congress, and then we have the thing we have today. Like, it's all that. Everything we're dealing with is just that, and it all came because at the end of the day, Hamilton wrote the damn general welfare clause and the interstate commerce clause into the Constitution, knowing full well that that's what would happen. Because they argued about it during the formation of the country and argued about it during the Second Constitutional Convention. And the Anti-Federalists wrote about this stuff then. And then in the 1930s, guess what? The Keynesians and the commies, led by FDR, drove a truck through those two clauses and justified the entire New Deal. And it wasn't just FDR, because honestly, the New Deal was just, you know, Hoover's Works Project Administration renamed. It wasn't anything new. So this is what we're dealing with today. We're dealing with a crescendo. What happens when you can't create more spending through the application of more debt? Because GDP is not gross national product. It's a misnomer. It's gross national spending. It's the only thing we can measure. How much money have we spent in the aggregate? And that's supposed to, in Keynesian math, which is, of course, you know, an oxymoron, because Keynesian math is an affront to math. Okay, that In Keynesian math, gross national spending equals demand for money. And demand for money is all that matters. And because demand for money is all that matters, the quantity side of the economy will take care of itself. These people believe this. They believe that the quantity of goods produced is only driven by the demand that we demand for them, and that somehow the quantity will take care of itself. Obviously not. You can print all the money in the world and keep people stuck in their homes under COVID, but if there's nobody out there working, there ain't no supply. If you give people the incentive to spend, to put, keep them on the dole, universal basic income, welfare, and they don't produce anything, then eventually, how do you produce any goods or services to feed these people who are sitting at home doing nothing? It doesn't work. The math doesn't function. At some point, all you're doing is issuing debt, and you can't stimulate supply construction with high taxes, high regulation, and a significant portion of the population sitting on their ass home playing video games and watching porn. But that's the future that they have planned for us, because they think the robots are going to do all the work or something. I haven't been able to figure out what these people are actually thinking, what they're going to actually move us into. Because what I see on the horizon is Mad Max. Hopefully not. Hopefully there are sovereigntist forces within the world that don't lead us down into Mad Maxdom, but it's not going to be too hard. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't fit into a pair of shoulder pads anymore, and I don't fit into my high school football helmet anymore either. So, you know, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, that's why I got goats and a 14-acre farm. Like, it's not tough. But at the same time, I also look at that going, I'm also 54 years old, and I don't want to be, you know, out there having to farm goats and run a victory garden and all the rest of it. I'm mentally prepared for it. I'm emotionally prepared for it. But physically, I don't want to do that. I don't even have time for it. Like, spending all day trying to help other people understand what's going on takes up all of my day and takes up all of my energy. At the end of the day, I don't want to go out and, like, you know, till potatoes or anything. Like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah. So I barely have enough time to, like, pet my dog and you know, power down from the day's annoyances.
Well, I appreciate you helping. I always joke I'm a minion because I just sit and I listen to all you fine folks who give up your time and you know, give a voice to trying to understand different things. And I sit here and I just try and soak it in so that I can be like, okay. Here I sit, Tom, and I go, I've had a whole diversity of people on to discuss, you know, what's going on. And I go, if you're some just regular person going right through the day, what is something you think they need to know about probably their money or their assets, what they have moving into the next year or decade or whatever time frame you think is? Because, like, so many things are just, you mentioned Mad Max, right?
Sean, we're in the moment where everything is going to change.
Right.
In the next 2 to 3 years, everything is going to change. The strength of the dollar right now, because the Federal Reserve is inviting a dollar bull market. The world of money is finally getting scared that the politicians don't have any answers and that the numbers don't add up, yada, yada, yada. I've talked to a couple of people recently, you know, that are like, yeah, like, I can see what's going on, and I'm not leaving U.S. equities because that's the only place to put my money. It's the only safe haven I got at this point. You know, I can put it in other things. But the point being is that if you can understand the policy of what's going on and the mindset of the people who are writing the policy, this is why everything I do starts there and then trickles down to a kind of a very simple set of action points, of actionable bits of advice. The order of operations is that the world is under collapse, and the question is, in what way, as this system collapses, who's going to die in what order? Okay, so that's the hard part. This is the part that nobody wants to talk about. Everybody wants to have their in the community. They all want to have their primary thesis that they wrote up 20 years ago, and then just stick with that and not really be. Wrong. I was wrong 20 years ago. I was wrong 10 years ago that the dollar was going to collapse before the euro. No, the euro is going to collapse. The euro is in the process of collapsing right now. So is the Great British Pound, right? So what does that mean? It means that policy in Washington is aggressive towards the global South, Russia, China, Iran, India, etc. The UK, because they're on the vestige, they're resting on, or they have the vestiges of the British Empire, are going along with this, and they're effectively the same group of people. You can call them the Straussians, you can call them the neoconservatives, you can call them, whatever you want to call them. Like, it ties into Paul Wolfowitz and the, you know, and Mackinder and Brzezinski and all of that stuff. You realize that those people have one agenda. Europe has another agenda, which is that they want their colonies back. They want the US back. They want the UK back. They don't want Italy to leave. They want to control North Africa. They want to control, they want some control over the Middle East. And they want to destroy Russia. So there's common purpose here between these two factions. Why do they want to control Russia? Because it's not that the World Economic Forum and the European Union is against Russian energy. They're against Russian energy because they don't control it. Okay, it's not about, they don't control Putin. They have no control over the Russian government system. They have no control over the Russian military. And so because they don't control it, they will do anything imaginable to get control of it. This has been British foreign policy for 150 years, to either stop Asian integration or destroy the Russian Empire and take it over from within. So much of our history, you can look at the last 150 years of American, British, and European history is that. You can look at World War I this way. You can look at World War II this way. You can look at the multiple wars in Afghanistan this way. You can look at, you know, why we overthrew the Shah, overthrew Mossadegh in 53, in Iran, all of it, all that. Why the British Empire was so obsessed with holding on to its assets in Asia and well into the end of World War II, because they didn't want Asia to do what it's doing now, which is to come together economically, politically, defensively, and everything else. So that's where we are. So what does the average person do when they look at this? So if you can understand that game point, and you can understand this, right? So you can understand that the world breaks down into like four different areas: Europe, the UK, the US, and then the Asian or global South, of the Russia, China, Iran axis. India is now part of that axis. Brazil is as well, the BRICS. But the real tripod of that power is not India and Brazil at this point. It's Russia, China, and Iran, because that's where Russia and China are putting their money. Russia and China are not necessarily at this point putting all their money in India, because India's tried to play both sides against the middle, similar to the way Turkey's been doing it. Just Russia, China, and Iran. Those are the three. If any of those fall, then they believe that they can collapse the whole thing, the whole project. So once you understand that, and you understand that Europe is caught in the middle, because the Russians and the Chinese understand what the Europeans are trying to do. The UK is fighting for its life. And the Americans have been sold out by their own politicians, because their politicians work for Europe, European globalists. Once you understand that, the board is really simple. And the Europeans are now caught between the Scylla of the Russians on the one side and the Charybdis of the American sovereignists on the other side. This is the basic thesis. We have a functional split at the top of the American government. There are, and the American oligarch, the most powerful lobby in the United States is not the military industrial complex. I hate to anger a whole bunch of leftists in the audience. It's not. It's the U.S. commercial banking interest. The banks are more powerful, period. Because the banks control the Federal Reserve, who controls monetary policy, who controls the cost of capital that Washington can dole out. They control Congress's purse strings if the Fed decides to hold back. Now, in the past, Congress has always been able to get away with this because it was always a market for our debt. Other central banks would buy it. Other, you know, foreign corporates would buy it. The American corporates would buy U.S. treasuries. But since we've been in the QE period of the last 14 years, who's the primary buyer, marginal buyer of U.S. debt? The Federal Reserve, who holds a a massive pile of U.S. Treasuries on their balance sheet or reserve. So if the Federal Reserve decides it's no longer likes Congress's spending shenanigans, Congress can't spend because they can't blackmail the Fed by selling, you know, U.S. Treasuries to Singapore Central Bank or China Central Bank or Japan Central Bank, right? So that, so I can go farther into this as to why the Fed has the leverage now to be able to pull this strategy off. And it has to do with the way debt is, the way the cost of capital is transmitted through the system. But that's probably beyond the scope of our discussion here. So once you understand that, now you have one giant, the Federal Reserve and U.S. sovereignty in the commercial banking system, fighting another giant up in the clouds, the old colonial European banks, Intesa San Paolo, UniCredit, Deutsche Bank, ING, Lloyds, all of those, right? Those guys, the ones that are going to, the BBVA, like all the big banks of the that were, you know, that are 500 years old. You see this stuff all the time. The oldest bank in Italy is in serious trouble. Yeah, 500 years old. I've got news for you. It is. It's also insolvent because the Italian government is insolvent. The only being propped up by the Germans buying the Italian debt through the ECB intermediary. So they're the most vulnerable. And that fight is going on right now. And our job is to figure out how not to get stepped on. Because we're an ant and they're giants. But we can avoid being stepped on. How do you do that? Well, you figure out where capital is that it's overvalued and where it's undervalued. And then you buy the undervalued asset because the overvalued asset is going to fall in price and it's going to rush into the undervalued asset. And what asset right now is more undervalued than gold? Right now, when gold was $2,100 an ounce, it's probably overvalued. But right now, it's gold. Is it going to go lower? Possibly. Why? Because there are a lot of people out there who are still biblically short dollars, and the structure of the gold market is that people use the paper gold trade in the futures market as a piggy bank in order to get dollars. It's nothing more than that. And they trade paper gold around, but they don't actually want gold. The guys who are sitting, most of 95% of the trading that happens on the gold futures exchanges around the world, well, in the West, in London and Chicago, has to do with people trying to figure out a way to hedge the currency risk to get dollars. And then when gold rallies, they sell the rallying and then shore up their dollar position because they have dollar liabilities that they need because they've got loans to service and they've got payroll to make and they've got all of that stuff. And that's why people demand dollars. The Federal Reserve is tightening the supply of dollars worldwide. So at this moment in time, and which is then setting off and popping off, you know, people not being able to pay their bills. So if the dollar supply is tightening up, then it makes sense in this first wave of this, the gold is going to get crushed. And I've been telling my people this the entire time. Don't panic. Let's watch it, see how it plays out. I'm all about gold. I love gold. I love Bitcoin. I love all hard assets. But there's a time and a place when they're going to be, that when the timing is going to work out for them. And right now, the Federal Reserve does not want a higher gold price, or not even that the Fed doesn't want a higher gold price. It's that there's just a lot of people out there who need dollars. And until that is finished, we're going to have deflation of assets that are tied to the supply and flow of dollars around the world. And if the flow of dollars is shrinking, the ones that are getting hit the hardest are, of course, corporate debt, stocks, home values, all of that stuff. And then, of course, by extension, mortgage-backed securities and all the rest of it. Okay, that's why the Fed is able to shrink its balance sheet and sell U.S. treasuries, but they're being a little slow in selling mortgage-backed securities. Or they're selling some and buying others. I mean, the Fed's playing a game with their tightening of the mortgage-backed security market. And rightly so, their first job is to protect the banks. That's their ultimate job. Because the banks, that's who they work for. That's who the shareholders are of the Federal Reserve. So why are we surprised when the Fed protects the banks? And then And then you hear, the incessant whining from the alternative left space, from the Wall Street on Parade types, from the Occupy Wall Street types, that the Fed is just another, you know, that they're, that why are they bailing out the banks? Well, because that's their job. What freaking world do you live in that the Fed would not defend the banks? It's what the Fed was designed to do. That's not some great conspiracy theory. It's just reality. And it's always been reality. Are you denying reality? Do you think the Fed works for you? Now, when choosing between a bunch of Eurocommie fascists, or Eurocommies that, you know, they're going to turn into fascists at some point anyway, because it all winds up being the same thing. There's going to wind, it's the EU is moving into wanting to become the USSR. When you've got your choice of Eurocommies on the one side and colonialists on the one side who want to destroy commercial banking, destroy the good, any good parts. They want to throw all the good parts of commercial banking out with the bad parts of commercial banking. They want to throw it all away. Get everybody up in arms fighting. Oh, the banks are all terrible, and the banks and the corporations. It's typical left-wing freaking pablum. It's nonsense. It's not wrong, but it's not right either. Okay? Because it's more nuanced than that. It's more important. Like, commercial banking isn't wrong, folks. It's how we built bridges. It's how we build buildings. It's how we get roads built. It's how you get schools built. It's how you get, you know, stop signs put up and all the rest of it. Without the commercial banking system to pool capital to build larger projects that you could build yourself, because you're not building a road. I live back a private road. I have to maintain my road. I know how expensive that shit is. Okay? Like, you know, you're not doing that. Like, you're not. So we need banks for these things. This is the basis of capital formation, is banking. In its purest form, in its best and most constructive form. It's a, ultimately should be, if it's done properly, an expression of community and sovereignty, local community and local sovereignty. We obviously don't do that, but we can't throw that idea out with, well, let's just replace it all with the central banks, which is what the Euro commies want to do over at the WEF. They want to get rid of the commercial banks, and they want to collapse the commercial banks' means of transmitting money into the market and collapse that, because we have a two-tiered system. It goes from the central bank to the commercial banks, right? And then from the commercial banks to you. They want to just cut out the middleman, put us all on a digital blockchain, and then have the government and the central bank decide whether or not you get to order a pizza because you've got, you know, your cholesterol's too high. Or you wrote something mean about Klaus Schwab on Twitter, so you know you don't get a car loan.
Or you had Tom Luongo on your podcast.
Or you had Tom Luongo. That's, man, the thing. And dude, I'm serious. That's where they want to take us. That's what deplatforming Alex Jones was all about. That's what going after Gab's payment processors was all about. That's what all of this stuff is all about. It's to chill people into not saying what needs to be said. And, you know, and get them, and then the blackmail them with their jobs, the COVID jabs, this, that. Well, you're going to argue all day long whether the COVID jab was good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not even here to talk about that. My opinion on that is irrelevant. Just like I always said, my opinion on the lockdowns was, the political and economic fallout of lockdowns was wrong, and who was benefiting from that, not whether or not the virus was real and people were dying or anything along those lines. None of that stuff. I only focused on the political fallout and the economic fallout. Could see that coming a mile away, and who was going to benefit from this. And of course, obviously, COVID, but the WEF just came out and said COVID was a dry run for what we're going to do when we have a full social credit system in place. Okay. Like, I take them at their word.
At this point, you should take them at their word, Tom. We just went through 2 years of it here in Canada, and we're still trying to pull ourselves out of it, if you will, because, I mean, we still got different restrictions.
Sean, I got good news for you. Disclosed TV just tweeted out about an hour or two ago that the Canada just lifted all COVID travel restrictions, including masks, everything else. So, yeah. And FYI, that doesn't happen if the Canadian banks weren't on board with what the Fed's doing. Like, the reason Trudeau was not able to get the Emergencies Act passed through the Canadian Senate, which was a massive moment in time, because the Canadian Senate usually just rubber stamps everything. Right. That was pressure from the banks who were already seeing bank runs from what Trudeau was doing. And the Canadian banks, I have this on good authority from people high up in the Canadian Conservative Party, that the Canadian banks told Trudeau and Freeland, that's not happening.
So why did they?
That, in the same way that the U.S. banks told Joe Biden that we're not going to have Lael Brainard as Fed chair, we're going to have Jerome Powell.
So why then did people have their bank accounts frozen then?
That stuff happened because, and they were able to get some of it done, but then from what I understand, those have been lifted, but they didn't get the full emergency.
I agree, but I guess the reason I bring it up is if the banks were against what Trudeau was doing with the emergency,
they were caught flat-footed by how quickly Trudeau was going to escalate,
even to the point of allowing in their own system for bank accounts to be frozen.
Well, dude, like they have to, like the banks are government charters; they have to listen. If the government makes a decree, they have to listen, even if otherwise look, bureaucrats are bureaucrats. Okay, so they're going to do whatever the government decrees until such time as they can use the political process to reverse that, which is exactly what happened. Okay, so it started. Best metaphor for you: Trudeau and Freeland reached for the boob too early on prom night and got their hands slapped. Done. It was over in a week. It should have gone on for months. But the power of the Canadian commercial banking system showed itself when the Canadian Senate, literally like a bunch of court stenographers, turned around and said, no. The same way that when British Parliament told David Cameron, no, we're not going along with Barack Obama to invade Syria in 2012, was a watershed moment, which led to Brexit, which almost directly leads to Brexit 4 years later. That moment by the Canadian Senate was a massive moment. Same way that the House of Lords tried to stop Brexit for months when they don't have any power either. When hard Brexit was going through the British Parliament, and the House of Lords kept trying to step in and stop this. Like you can see, and the House of Lords is full Davos. Full globalist, European globalist, whereas, you know, we had hard Brexiteers elected to Parliament. And you had the referendum that they had to, you know, honor. It's the same thing was happening in Canada. The whole thing with the banks, the banks put the kibosh on this so quickly. And they're absolutely like, no, this is why Freeland, by the way, is now angling for a job over at NATO, because she knows she's not going to be in power much longer. She wants her golden parachute. She wants her next stepping stone. Because like Pelosi knows that the Democrats are going to get shellacked in 6 weeks, and she wants to become ambassador to Italy. She wants her gold watch for time served. Okay? We're in this moment now where these people are all reaching for the boob too early on prom night because all of their power that they bought off for all these years is all 82 years old. And either is a drunk like Pelosi or demented like Biden, or so many of the geriatrics in Congress could drop dead tomorrow from a stroke. Half of them are like, you know, TIA victims. You can see it. I mean, my mom was in the last years of my mom's life, I look at Pelosi and I look at her face and I'm like, how many TIAs have you had, honey? Oh no, you're just a drunk. Got it. Okay, never mind. it's hard to tell sometimes.
With time slowly closing in, because I don't have you all morning, and I've really enjoyed your thoughts. I just want to bring us to a couple, two, three current events, if you will, and your thoughts on it. One is you talk about the banks and all these different things being the absolute powers. One that
they have more power.
Sure. One of the ones that I wanted to bring up was the Vatican. Pope mm-hmm. Francis had ordered the Holy See and connected entities to move all their financial assets back into the Vatican by the end of mm-hmm. September. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? Or what do you think people should know about that?
They're prepping for the... Okay, with the Italian elections, ending the way they have, which was no surprise to anybody. Okay. And we're doing this in the morning after the results.
Right. And it was a landslide win for the.
That's a nice way of putting it. I think that's overstated.
Okay.
Okay. But again, I take me 10 minutes to go through the vagaries of Italian politics to explain why.
Okay.
But the nuance is, simply put, it's good. The Brothers of Italy winning, good. Why? Because they are the most nationalist, sovereigntist of the three center-right parties. Okay. It does not make them not fascists or not economic, not socialists in terms of economic planning. Of course they are, because they're Italian. And unfortunately, that's just where they are. Like, there isn't much, you know, these people are definitely civil libertarians, but they're not economic libertarians at all. So what passes for the far right in Italy wouldn't get through the door at a Libertarian Party convention here in the United States. Like, it's not, or even a Republican, you know. But everybody's moved so far left that it's crazy. And the left at this point have just basically said, if you're one step right of Karl Marx, you're a fascist or a Nazi or someone or whatever the hell you are at this point. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, even Marx, I think, is too right wing for most Marxists today. If you really listen to them talk.
It's quite
scary. So the Italian elections and the Pope are intertwined here. The Pope was obviously put in place by Davos. He's not even Catholic, for Christ's sake, as far as I'm concerned. He's definitely a Marxist. So either one of two things happened, and I can't really tell you. One of two things happened. Either, again, going back to my argument, the U.S. is trying to break the European Union. Because the European Union and the Davos, nominally, their power comes from the offshore dollar markets, and it comes from their banking system, their old banking system, the ability to use all those dollars to buy pelf and privilege and start wars and everything else. Well, who collapsed the Italian government 3 months ago? Was it Davos in preparation for bringing in a new Italian Trojan horse to run the country? Or was it American forces behind the scenes forcing a collapse of the Draghi government, which brought us to these elections, and now the Pope can see what's coming next, which is that there's going to be an epic fight for the control of Italy between the Americans and Europe, and the Pope is just trying to secure the Vatican's assets against the collapse of the Italian banking system, which is clearly on the horizon now, because Davos's best weapon against Giorgia Meloni and the Brothers of Italy is, if she gets uppity, is to demand their $1.something trillion in Target 2 liabilities that they owed the Germans. You want to leave Italy? You want to leave the EU? No, you can't do that. Now, if you listen to Giorgia Meloni's acceptance speech this morning, she was very clear that she believes in staying with NATO, staying the course on, not fracturing the alliance over the Russia-Ukraine war and all of that. A lot of people have misread this into thinking that that makes her a Davos. No. She's actually working for the ridiculous American neocons. Again, this now that where they had alliance over Russia and Ukraine, that's being broken apart. And now the Americans are trying to beat the Europeans into submission. But at the same time, the American banks know that beating Russia into submission is a bad thing. So there's a lot of it. This is a very fluid situation. Okay. So Meloni is going to go to war over with Brussels over the future of Italy's money and its economic and political future, but doing so for American purposes, with American backing. Whether they, how that plays out, I'm still really thinking about this. Part of the reason why I have to go soon is I need to sit down and chat with a friend of mine over in Italy and get a sense of what's going on. So tune in a couple of weeks and I'll probably have some more nuanced thoughts on this, but it's a very, very complicated situation. So that's what I think is going on with the Pope. And I may be wrong about that. Could be the exact opposite, that he knows that that Europe is going to blackmail the Italians, crash all the banks, and then see where, and then you know, leave everything for Maloney to pick up, and then see her, you know, thrown out of office and lynched in the ensuing destruction. You know, without American support, she's going to get roasted. So,
with you saying Davos installed the Pope, or something along that lines.
Yeah. I mean, Pope Benedict never abdicated. And you can't abdicate. It's against the rules. Like, he abdicated, but you can't abdicate being Pope. You can die. I mean, this is, the Catholics have been talking about this for years. It's just sincere. Like, this guy is the usurper Pope. He's not the real Pope. Benedict's still Pope by Vatican law. He's still Pope. But he was deposed in a coup. And this shitbag Marxist was installed.
If you're,
and I barely understand this stuff, but I know that that's the argument.
Well, I may have
some of the legal details, like
that's fine. That's fine. To my brain, I'm once again, if there's ant, I am one of those. I'm running around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I get
so
it.
Am I.
When you say that, like, if you're a faith-based person in that faith, should that not scare the living hell out of you?
Of course it does. You should hear how, I mean, the Catholics that I've talked to about this are fuming mad.
How isn't this a bigger, maybe it is a big story.
A big story. How is it not a bigger story? Because who controls the freaking media? The very people that we're talking about. Who do you think controls all your media? It's the same people. The MI6, the British aristocracy, and the European aristocracy, they control our media. That's just starting to change.
Man, that's a scary thought. Like, once again, sorry, the media
who's,
thing.
I mean, who controls who gets to have a microphone on Twitter? Like, one of my disciples, Phil Gibson, this morning, right before we got on, said, I guess I must have pimped Maloney too hard on Twitter this morning, because I just got put in Twitter jail for it, for saying nice things about Georgia Maloney. Okay. That's all he said. I read the tweets. I'm like, okay. And they put him in jail, or Twitter jail.
Let me ask you this, Tom. If somebody's listening to this, and certainly here in Canada, if they're listening to my show, they know all about how media only talked about one bloody, you know, like, it was so
one side of the equation.
Yeah. Oh, not even one side of the equation. It was like one variable in the fucking equation. It was unbelievable.
It is. It's crazy. Tom Woods calls it the 3x5 index cards of allowable speech.
Let's say somebody is listening to this and goes, holy shit, what is Tom reading? What is Tom looking at? Can you give a couple?
I'll tell you. This is just years of honing your political instincts to be able to read between the lines. You can't read something and get this. I mean, you can read individual. I mean, you can read a lot of different places.
Sorry, I get an idea.
But what you really have to do is just, like, read between the lines of what's been said.
Sorry, I'll rephrase that. I didn't mean a book. Sure. I don't mean, like, here's the book, read this, and you get the grand plan. Exactly.
More. No, I mean, even people.
What does Tom pay attention to? Is it certain interactions? Is it certain world events?
It's certain things coming out of certain places. It's knowing who works for whom. It's knowing that, for example, the Washington Times works for the neocons on K Street, but the Washington Post works for the CIA. It means it seriously, and the New York Times. It means that the Hill is the mouthpiece of the Democratic Party. It means that you have to know that Politico and the Huffington Post, or useful, it used to be the Huffington Post, and Axios and all them work for the American establishment, establishment. You have to realize that the Weekly Standard, you know, the whole Bill Buckley set, they're a neocon rag. You need to know the American conservative is mostly libertarian and most kind of Pat Buchanan style paleo conservatives, but they've been marginalized. You have to know who these people are to know what's coming through. You have to know that oilprice.com, for example, if you want information about the oil industry, is equally is equally telling you the Russian side of the story and the MI6 side of the story. Like, seriously, like when you read an article at Oil Price, for example, which is a very good site, we need to know that Irina Sov talks to the Russian side of the equation, and, you know, Cyril Wittershoven and Simon Watkins are friggin' literal MI6 agents. And then you have to know that Stratfor is run by George Friedman, who's a CIA asset, and that 75% of the stuff you read on American foreign policy comes from Stratfor talking points, and then they just repeat them. And then you got to know what Davos is, and you can see from the concentration of what the talking points are whenever, you know, within the Overton window of that week. You go, oh well, there, you know, the call came out. Call Georgia Maloney far right. Bring up her and make sure that you tie her directly to Mussolini. Okay. But we never hear about Ursula von der Leyen and her Nazi roots, right? Even if it's, you know, even if it's tenuous, even if it's not really real, even if it was just that her grandfather was like every other middle-aged German, got drafted into the army and was a Nazi, right? The Wehrmacht was a Nazi. Doesn't mean anything. It's just guilt by association. Or is it? Okay. Does it matter that, you know, Victoria Nuland, the Undersecretary for European Affairs, effectively the second most powerful person in the U.S. State Department? You know, grandfather was a Ukrainian Jew who was killed by Russians. Does that matter? Is that important? Kind of is. Because personnel is policy. So the words that come out of the various people's mouths matter. The people that mouth the words and say the words at a particular moment in time matter. Timing is important. Like, everything is important. And you just have to, like, be in this fight so long that you can see it that way. That's my job. My job is to go, oh, that's what it is. Your job is to go out and produce something great today that serves mankind. So I free up your day so you don't have to spend 4 hours a day like pouring over this stuff it's just like have me on once a month and like get the download and then go on about your life and go, you know, produce soybeans or not soybeans, but go produce, you know, cows and pigs and, you know, fix roads make sure the electoral lines are working and get out here to fix my freaking DSL service. It would be awesome. And I'll pay you for it. Like, you know, that's the world we have to live in. And these people are absolutely, you know, they think that the only way we're going to survive as a species is to do away with capital formation and then institute global communism. They're nuts. They're insane. It's what we got. It's reality. Is it going to work? No. Is it going to bankrupt hundreds of millions of people? Yes. Is it going to start a world war? Very likely. Are we going to be better off on the other side of it? Most likely. I mean, seriously, it's not like I'm not telling you, I'm telling you there's this hope and that there's a path forward that gets us to the other side somewhat with our liberties intact, but it doesn't mean that it's not going to suck. Because the only way out of this is through it. You can't circumvent it. You can't go around it. Yeah. Some of us can. You can, you know, expat, you can do some other things. Sure. And capital will do that. A lot of people are moving to Mexico. Some people are moving to Paraguay. Saw a lot of people are moving to Florida. In the hopes that DeSantis takes us out of the union, you know, I mean, like, there's all sorts of things going on, but, you know, concentrate. But, you know, it's the old libertarian idea of the free state project. Concentrate people of like-mindedness in an area and change the politics. And the free state project as a concept failed in New Hampshire, or, you know, in practice failed in New Hampshire, because getting the libertarians to agree about anything is like, you know, like, I don't know. It's like trying to put spilled milk back in the bottle. But, because I hate to use the phrase herding cats because it's, you know, it's old. But the concept is not a bad one, because you're seeing people do it now. You're seeing a mass exodus to places where there's still sanity.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Tom. I got a couple extra minutes here where we're going to do the final question of the of the show. But I really appreciate you coming on. And I can already hear the audience when they tune into this saying you need to come back on. So that means, Tom, I'm going to have you back on.
Sure.
And we'll continue to let you do your thing, because it's been a quick hour. But the final question goes like this. First off, shout out to Crude Master. Ethan Trace McDonald, been supporters of the podcast since the very beginning. And the question is, he said, if you're going to stand behind something, then stand behind it. Mm-hmm. What does Tom stand behind?
It's a good question. I stand behind my principles and I stand behind my analysis. I believe in people. I really do. It's a really good question because it's a hard way to frame it. Because you know, what do you mean by stand behind? Like, I have curated an amazing group of people as my patrons who teach me as much as I teach them. So I stand behind my ability to stay mostly humble in the face of a hostile universe and the fact that I don't know everything. I may sound informed, but I know nothing. And you have to, like, you have to remain humble in the face of all the information. You're doing your best with bad information. And you have to realize that there are solutions out there that you've never even considered. And you have to trust that those solutions may possibly get implemented. And every intervention into the market incentivizes somebody to find a workaround. And eventually that workaround will overwhelm the interventions and cause that system to eventually be done away with. Well, I don't care if we're talking Uber getting rid of taxi medallions or, you know, or even, you know, or the arguments that Bitcoin maximalists make about Bitcoin and fiat money, like is the common parlance of the day, the big one from the day. It doesn't matter what it is, even if we're talking about, you know, trying to destroy all culture, right? And all things that give people comfort and, you know, a way of navigating this, which they're clearly going at every level. Like they're trying to destroy all of our cultural institutions, the concept of even heroics itself, they're trying to do away with. Like, so I stand behind the argument that people are more than capable of producing unbelievable things despite all of this nonsense, as opposed to having given in to the nihilism that people suck because they do this to each other. When you look around the world today and you see the amazing things that people are continuing to do to each other in the face of the people doing all of these things to each other, that's what should give you, not hope, because I don't like the word hope, because hope is one letter away from cope, and it's the most negative of human emotions, because it's that which you have when you have nothing else. It should inspire you to continue to get out of bed in the morning and try and figure out a way to serve your fellow man. Because if you can serve your fellow man, you're serving yourself. The essence of free market economics, as the late, great Gary North used to say, is service. So I stand behind my pledge to service, to serve people as best as I can. And then let the chips fall where they may. I'm not going to be right about it. But the only thing I can do is try and, you know, arrogate and curate. Arrogate to me people who can help me and curate those ideas into a workable form that sometimes I can't even do because there's so much to talk about. There's so many ways to have to justify, you know, the argument that may be so far removed from somebody's frame of reference. At first you have to like, okay, well, what's happening here? And then I have to go back and explain for half an hour. And it sounds like I'm being elliptical and not answering the question, but really what I'm doing is tracing the backstory, right? But I have to stand behind that. And I have to try and figure out what's coming next. And if we can do that and we can, you know, remain reasonably generous, we'll get through it.
Well,
because these people are nuts. I mean, they really are. They're just insane. Right?
I've really enjoyed this, Tom. I pretty much sat back, you know, as the audience is probably thinking, I just sat back and took it all in. I really enjoyed you coming on and giving me an hour this morning. And I want to make sure that I hold true to getting you out of here on time so you can carry on with your busy day. But I do mean it. We'll have you back on because it's been a real fast hour. And a thought-provoking hour, I would say that the audience is gonna well, is gonna, and that's what I and that's what you look for in podcasting world. Yeah. That's what you want.
Well, yeah, I mean, I live by two adages, right? I live the one is be interesting or be ignored, and then the truth sells itself, right? And you have to provoke thought in people, even if they don't like it, and especially if they don't like it, because it's that's what takes people out of their comfort zone and gets them to start doing what Ayn Rand always said. It was just check your premises. Rand was, you know, wrong about a great many things and whatnot, but she was not wrong about that. It's Ayn Rand, like everybody else in the world, is a mix of good and bad things, right? And, you know, for personal philosophy, I find, you know, mostly abhorrent perversion of the non-aggression principle and libertarian ethics and all of that. But she's not wrong about, you know, always checking your premises. And so that's what I hope to do when I do one of these. And then we go from there. And then if you have any questions or comments, or you think I'm a jerk, or you think I'm an idiot, or, you know, whatever, that's cool. If I triggered you, well, you should really think about why you're triggered and not that I triggered you and I'm the bad guy. Because invariably, when you get triggered and or I get triggered, it's because it's something about us personally that we haven't addressed personally. Okay. So when I listen to Ursula von der Leyen speak, and I'm having like flashbacks to my mom, it's me. But that's okay. I know what that looks like, and I know that's evil and we need to deal. And you know what I mean? Like, but it's still triggering, but understand where that trigger is coming from and then work with it. So there we go.
All right? Appreciate it. Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.